Okay, everyone, we're going to get started. This session is reporting from the front lines of climate and energy, and we have four wonderful panelists here to talk with you. And there's a lot of rich and important discussions we can have about reporting from the front lines. So, in the spirit of diving right in, I'm going to give a really quick introduction to each of these panelists, and then we're going to talk really quick about a definition of what we mean by frontline communities, so we can kind of set the tone of this discussion. And then we'll head into some other discussion, and then at the end I'll give you guys some time to ask questions and of the panelists. So I'm Madeline Ostrander. I'm a freelance journalist based in Seattle. I focus primarily on narrative journalism and stories about climate change and environmental justice. And I used to be the senior editor of Yes Magazine. And I just finished a book called At Home on an Unruly Planet that tells the stories of a series of communities that are facing the impacts of climate change at home. And are you holding up my tiny cover? I have a business card with a tiny cover. and it's also more broadly about what it means when we confront climate change in the places that we live in and the places that we care about. And that'll be out in August from Henry Holt. So that's my little advertisement. to my right is Rachel Ramirez, who is a general assignment writer for the climate team at CNN, and she writes about a wide range of climate change and environmental justice topics, including renewable energy, militarization, and extreme weather events that lead to climate migration. Next to Rachel is Antonia Juhas. Antonia is an energy and climate investigative journalist. She writes for a wide range of publications, including Rolling Stone, National Geographic, Harper's Magazine, and The Atlantic. And Antonia has written three books, most recently Black Tide and the Tyranny of Oil. And she lives in New Orleans and teaches at Tulane University. And then beside Antonia, we have Juan Parras, who is the founder and executive director of TEJAS, which stands for Texas Environmental Justice Advocacy Services. Juan has a more than four decades long career as a community organizer and advocate for labor rights, environmental justice, and community resilience. And he was one of the original members of the National Environmental Justice Advisory Council, which is a federal advisory committee that advises the EPA, and it was established in 1993. And then the end there is Hallie Parker. Hallie is the coastal desk reporter for New Orleans Public Radio. She was also previously an environment reporter for the Times-Picayune. And Hallie focuses on stories about Louisiana's coastal land loss, climate change, and environmental issues in Black, Brown, and Indigenous communities. So that's our panel. There's been a lot of really great discussion at this conference about environmental justice and about frontline communities, and I've been pleased to see how much, how important that conversation has become to everyone, and it dovetails really nicely with this session. But I still thought that it would be helpful, really quick, to start with a definition before we get into talking about the work of these fabulous, smart people up here. So I'm going to start with one that I pulled from the Georgetown Climate Center, and then I'm going to ask if these guys want to elaborate on it a little bit. The Georgetown Climate Center says, frontline communities include people who are both highly exposed to climate risks because of the places they live and the projected changes expected to occur in those places, and have fewer resources, capacity, safety nets, or political power to respond to those. Frontline communities are those that experience the, quote, first and worst consequences of climate change. And then as I was thinking about what else I would add to that definition, I think frontline communities are often a combination of overlapping risks from the climate crisis, from the impacts of fossil fuel industries, and from a series of other threats that are connected to histories of discrimination and industrialization. And part of the tremendous complexity of reporting about them, and why I thought, you know, why we all thought that we wanted to talk about it, is that you have to navigate all of those factors and find the path or the story through them so that your audience can make the connections and understand the cumulative impacts. So those are some thoughts. What else do you guys think? Is there anything you would add to that set of ideas?
Hi, everyone. Thanks for being here. I think one thing I'd add is kind of like the literal definition of frontline in a military sense. Like, you're in the line closest to the enemy, and who's the enemy, which is, that could be any climate change fuel disaster, or a fossil fuel industry, oil and gas refineries, petrochemical refineries, and so that's what I would think, kind of in the literal sense.
Yeah, I'd just say that I think when we talk about frontline communities, it means, in my usage, communities that live on the front lines of fossil fuels and the climate crisis specifically, and so it really translates similarly into fence line communities, those that live closest to either the operations or the impacts.
I know we had to define it, but...
It's not a homework assignment. It's okay.
Well, if you think about, you know, what the kind of work that we're doing and talking about frontline communities, a lot of us that have lived on the front lines never knew that these issues were impacting us, right, to some degree. So it's an issue that we take to heart when we're addressing these communities that are inundated with hazardous air pollutants all day in and day out, all the traffic, you know, truck 18-wheelers that come into your neighborhoods and whatnot. So it's, I know it's been around since 1994, but it's still a new issue to a lot of communities that are impacted in different ways by environmental toxins, and they're just unaware of it like we were for the longest, forever, basically. Thank you.
I echo everything
you
said.
Great. Just a quick sound check. How are we doing on amplification? Can you guys hear everybody? Okay. I have the sense that maybe these are the kind of mics you have to really lean into. I don't know. Is that not true? Oh, is it too loud? All right, I'll lean back. Sorry. All right. Okay, so now we have a question that's for everybody that we wanted to give everyone a chance to kind of dive in and introduce, say a little bit about their work and, you know, kind of what some lessons they've learned about it. So, can you all give us an example of a story or a set of stories that you've worked on that were in or about frontline communities, whether as a journalist or, in Juan's case, as a community member working with journalists? And then is there a lesson that you've taken away from that experience that you think journalists could really learn from? And anyone can start.
Yeah, so before CNN, and just for background, CNN created its own climate team in June last year, and so we're kind of less than a year, we're turning a year this June, and prior to that, I was at GRIST covering environmental justice and climate justice, so that's kind of my background, and also I was born and raised in an island north of Guam called Saipan. It's in the Northern Mariana Islands, it's a U.S. territory, and so... I guess what made me think of, you know, for a story that I worked on is back in 2018, this super typhoon Yutu, I don't know if any of you heard of it, basically pummeled my hometown of Saipan. It was a Category 5 storm, plus storm, they would say. It was stronger than Hurricane Maria, actually. And it had 180 miles per hour wind and gusts. It was terrible. I was in the newsroom, and I was an intern at the Financial Times then. And my parents and my sister were there, and I kind of lost contact with them. And so it was this terrible thing where a lot of people actually lost their homes, and the biggest middle school in the Northern Mariana Islands just got completely obliterated. It was just a race. And so, and even my high school and just like the place that I grew up was really ruined. And so I had asked Gris, when I got hired at Gris, I wanted to do kind of follow-up stories on that typhoon. And so I did a bunch, like almost a year-long reporting on that. And so I did a year later, look back at Super Typhoon Yutu and its impacts. I went back home. Assess the damages, and just seeing kind of, I came back 7 months after the typhoon, and I saw the middle school that a lot of my friends went to, just gone. And the students who were in that middle school were literally having classes in, you know, those like FEMA brown kind of military-looking tents. And so they were there for like a year or so, and a lot of people still live. And so it's kind of striking when you think about community members who are living in those temporary tents and then going to school, especially for those kids going to school in those tents. And a lot of the people that I talked to would say, like, they would, you know, like, a lot of the kids would just be subconscious about, like, using kind of donations to wear to school, like, bags and clothes and stuff like that. And, you know, you're at that age where you're, it's really heartbreaking when you're on the ground. Anyway, I reported on that, long story short, and it's up on GRIS, and, you know, we call it the Paradise Lost. And I guess kind of my takeaway is that, you know, if you're covering environmental justice and climate justice, especially as a national reporter, don't forget sort of that it's not just concentrated in the mainland U.S., it's also Puerto Rico's not the only U.S. territory. We have the Northern Mariana Islands, we have Guam, we have American Samoa, we have the U.S. Virgin Islands, who also got pummeled by Hurricane Maria, yet, you know, Puerto Rico, I mean, it's not, I'm not frowning upon just the focus on Puerto Rico, but U.S. Virgin Islands also got impacted by that. And so, you know, just saying that we have territories, these are people, these are U.S. citizens who live in U.S. territories, but they can't vote for president. They have the same FEMA regulations. They have the same laws as us, but again, they can't vote for president. So they're kind of like also lagging behind in a lot of kind of the recovery process. I think I'll just stop there. I think I've been babbling enough.
No, that was great. who else?
Okay, so as I was preparing for this panel, I was thinking about the fact that I'm probably much older than my fellow journalists, probably by some significant degree. So I've been reporting from the front lines of fossil fuels and then increasingly the climate crisis for over a decade. And I've reported in frontline communities from Afghanistan to the Ecuadorian Amazon, the Arctic, across the Gulf Coast, most in Louisiana, particularly most recently. And there are so many stories that I didn't feel like I could select it into a few. So I thought I'd just do sort of two key observations that I thought might be most useful for our reporting. And I'd say the first one is the critical importance of the fact that those communities that are on the front lines of fossil fuels and increasingly the climate crisis have been for decades, and in some cases since the beginning of the fossil fuel era, for 150 years. And they have the expertise, the experience, the solutions that have always been there and have been present and primarily marginalized, because these are so often marginalized communities, solutions found among communities of color, among women, who have been putting them forward for decades, 150 years, but have not been listened to and are increasingly being listened to. And I think the IPCC is getting ready to release its new report, but in the last report that was just released, the IPCC really made this point that it is crucial that those voices, frontline, on the ground, most impacted communities, voices are crucial, are imperative towards achieving solutions to the climate crisis. That's one of those many pieces that were in the IPCC report that weren't reported. Mm-hmm. And in bringing that to our editors, to our audiences, not only is that factually a factual necessity to report that expertise, that experience, that knowledge, and those solutions, but it's also a hopeful message that audiences, readers, really appreciate, that there is not only this crisis within communities, which is of course real, but there is this rich wealth of organizing solutions activity, and that second piece also does not get reported enough. But then I would say the more challenging piece, which is also part of that, is that because these same communities have been on the front lines of fossil fuels and now increasingly climate crises for so long,
the hardships are compounding, and they get built upon. So, of course, if you're here in Houston, for those who haven't seen it or covered it, you have a community that lives right next to a fossil fuel operation. A storm comes in. The storm then impacts the fossil fuel operation. It then spews more oil, more chemicals, more releases. That then pollutes the community more. The community is also dealing with the climate crisis. And these compounding impacts are exhausting to frontline communities. And so when you are reporting on these communities, they are increasingly also dealing with so much, and also often so many journalists coming through. So the good news is there's more of us who want to report these stories, and should. The other piece of that is that the communities are also having to deal with journalists more. And so the first time that I should experience where I'm getting to with this, and I will wrap it up quickly, is when I was reporting on the BP Deepwater Horizon disaster. This was the first time I experienced what I'm about to share, which is those communities that I was reporting from had just experienced Katrina. And in addition to the hardship of Katrina, there was a lot of reporters who came through for Katrina. And this was the first time then when I came through reporting for BP that I experienced people saying to me, I'm exhausted with talking to reporters. What's the point of me talking to you? Really, you need to tell me what my community are going to get. And that is a really important question, and I'm definitely experiencing that more and more and more and more as a journalist, is communities feeling this sort of double exhaustion of the difficulties they're facing and working with reporters. And so it is something I really want to grapple with and talk about, which is how that we address that with reporters, the necessity to cover the story and not add an undue burden onto the people whose story you are sharing by reporting your story.
Hold on, I'm not a journalist, okay?
That's why you're here.
But from a community position, one of the things that we told the administrator, EPA administrator recently, Wiegand, is that we told him, you're the third EPA administrator that has come to our community. So that's a lot of years, right? And I said, and so far nothing has been done to address the problems that we have told you about. And we sent him a whole, I guess, list of articles that have been written over the last 15, 20 years. And they all basically draw the same conclusion, you know, from journalism, and it's pretty obvious. And they make recommendations, and still they continue not to address those issues. But recently, most recently, what really, I guess, shows the impact of who gets help and who doesn't is that we have a community called Fifth Ward, primarily African Americans, and they had soil contamination of creosote. Their congressional representative spoke up, and they immediately got help. And so, again, I blame a lot of the resistance to helping our communities because we're on the fence line of the industry, because the creosote is way of, it's far away from the industrial facilities, right? So politically, I don't think that our elected officials want to aspirate ahead for Manchester because they also get a lot of political resources, you know, to run their campaigns. And then, unfortunately, our congressional representative would not speak out on it. Our state representative does not speak out on it. And our state representative actually lives in Manchester. Her parents live in Manchester. And so we have this political force that knows the issues, well aware of it, and knowledgeable, but they refuse to speak up even on behalf of their community. So those are obstacles that we're facing. The issues are there. They're legitimized by all this reporting that's been going on, but we have the lack of political will. And this is what happens in a lot of communities. The lack of political will from those that can make a difference do not step up to the plate because they want to be reelected first, and then also because it's an issue that a lot of folks don't really want to get involved with because it can be very personal, you know, when you get involved in dealing with communities. So, impacted in the situation like Manchester, what are the options? Do you tell the industry to move away, or do you get relocation? There's a lot of things that you have to sort of cross over to address those issues. And so I'll stop there because, you know, I know we're not going to solve the issues right now, so I'll pass it on. Thank you.
That was great
work. Yeah.
And kind of going off of what Antonia was talking about, just in terms of how these are compounding impacts, I think it's really important. I report in Louisiana, and there's, you know, this chemical corridor nicknamed Cancer Alley there. And I think that when I'm doing stories in that area, I think it's really important to provide historical context so that people know that it's not like, this is just happening, but they actually understand why it's happening, and understanding that, you know, in Louisiana, this goes back to the plantation era and slavery, and that's what really enabled these issues to take place, and that's why Black people and lower income communities are more affected by this pollution. And so I just wanted to say that it's important to have that kind of context in your story so that people can connect the dots and understand, like, why environmental racism is a thing and exists. Mm-hmm. So.
Thanks for all those. I thought I would add one small thought that I kind of heard Dan Fagan reflect on yesterday, but that I also had been reflecting on, which is just that, one of the things that's part of my background when I was doing my graduate work, which was not in journalism, was that I was doing a lot of work in what's called participatory research, where you're really kind of getting the input of a community that you're working in on what are the research questions that you're asking, and, you know, what's the story or the outcome or the information that is helpful to them. And I found that set of questions to be really helpful in my journalism, especially when I'm reporting in frontline communities, for a lot of the reasons that Antonia and Hallie were, you know, just talking about, like, if you're not asking the questions about, like, what is the story that this community really needs to have told, then I think, you're not going to have as powerful a story. And so, like, your willingness to, like, take that in and hear that input and allow it to guide what you're writing and reporting, I think, is really important, especially in places like this that are facing so many vulnerabilities and have dealt with, you know, so many things over the years. So that's my one thought. Yeah. Absolutely.
I just also want to say that this type of information doesn't have to be pulled and crammed just into one story. Like, there's the opportunity to do more coverage and come back to it. Like, I know for me, talking to communities, a lot of times they have their own solutions and, like, things that they would like to have help with getting done. And maybe I can't fully explain all of that in one story, but that's something that I can go back to and talk about in a future story. So I just want to mention that, and really elevating what they want to be done in their community to help solve these problems.
Yeah, that's great. So this is sort of a question for the journalists, although one you're welcome to jump into, but I guess I just wondered, we talked before this panel, the group of us, about some of the kinds of barriers to covering environmental justice and climate justice stories, different kinds of outlets, including, like, whether you have editorial support or not, and how stories are siloed. Can you guys talk about your experiences with that? What do you think editors and other reporters need to know about why they should make these stories possible, and, like, what you need to make the stories succeed?
As I said, I was at Grist before CNN, and so it was definitely, the dynamics were definitely different in the newsroom, where at Grist I could just sort of, you know, I could just pitch a story that's climate related, and my editors would, you know, see that connection and kind of have that support for my story idea. But at CNN, we all know that's background, meteorology background. And so they really still depend on the science. And so I guess for me, my barrier is just, like, having to work extra hard to pitch a story and really make that connection, climate connection, clear. And it's kind of like I really have to spell it out and have the scientific points to back an X story about a frontline community and why, you know, emissions from a military facility or a petrochemical facility is not only affecting the climate, but also the health of our communities. And so really having to spell that out in all my pitches is, at CNN, was really a barrier for me. But, you know, it's something that a big organization like CNN could learn from. And, you know, like I said, we haven't been a year yet, and it's something that we're trying to grow and trying to do better of. And so just having to spell that connection, that climate connection, in all of my stories, from reporting on what a hurricane means when you live in Cancer Alley, why it matters, selling those impact stories. And, you know, as my friend Justin Moreland said, as you probably heard yesterday, climate is everything. And so just really emphasizing that to my editors. And it can be a barrier, but it's a barrier that we're learning to sort of overcome. And I'd love to hear from my fellow panelists on how, what their experiences are as well, and kind of pitching those stories. And, yeah,
I mean, just to echo you, editorial support is very important for these kinds of stories. And not, I don't know, I think that there's often like a high barrier when you're pitching that you kind of have to overcome, just because a lot of editors maybe don't have education on the editor's part, maybe taking the initiative to understand the dynamics of these types of situations. Spend time there, even if it's not directly connected to a specific story that they're going to do. Like sometimes, I mean, for me at least, I spent a few months just going to different community events and chatting with people for a industrial facility that was planned. And so going to their events, not necessarily writing a story about that specific event, but just building those relationships, making those connections. I think that that's something that's important, so that you can build trust with those types of communities, and also just have more background yourself as someone who's not from that area to understand what they're going through and the history and that sort of thing. So, yeah, and I also think that maybe you should be a little bit more respect when it comes to editors, or, again, education around language choices. In terms of switching language and stories, sometimes there's, you know, there's probably a reason why I wrote something a certain way, and it can be difficult to argue, and also tiring. So it'd be nice to get a better, I guess, more support with that. So, until me.
So hard. Yeah. So I am going to say I have wonderful relationships with all the white men who are my editors, but we also have to say that almost all editors are white men. And that's something we have to name. So there is much, much, much more representation coming now among journalists, journalists of color, women who are journalists, but that has not really made it into the editorial space, and it certainly hasn't made it into, you know, the upper echelons of executives. And again, to repeat, that we have better representation among our editors. And I think, you know, we do face significant barriers in reporting on environmental justice and climate justice stories from environmental justice and climate justice communities, with understanding language, understanding the time and respect that's needed to report from these communities. And I think that can only be helped by greater representation across the whole breadth of our, you know, our medium. But one thing I think is really important is, we've gone through it as a story that needs to be told, money going to it, right? 20 new reporters, climate reporters at the AP, 20 new climate reporters at the Washington Post, the new climate desk at CNN, and that transformation is so important, and it's so fundamentally changed the entire dialogue about we all get now. It wasn't that long ago, remember, it was only a couple years ago that we couldn't agree in our media reporting that the climate crisis was just something we could say is real, that requires action, that we don't have to, you know, elevate the mysterious three well-funded people who claim the other thing. But that wasn't that long ago, and we're all kind of forgetting it, I think, really quickly. Because we've moved very rapidly into this transformative space where now we know we need to talk about it differently, and that space is opening up a space on climate justice. But we need to do the same thing with fossil fuels, right? Fossil fuels are the cause of the climate crisis, and we have to talk about fossil fuels and the communities that confront them
as those communities that are in facing the same necessity of this thing needs to be transformed, it needs to have solutions, we have solutions, and that's a given space. It needs to be in justice and climate justice communities who are on the front lines of fossil fuel scientific fact that fossil fuels are responsible for 90% of the CO2 emissions that we're trying to get rid of is really important, is that you cannot confront the climate crisis without the stories, impacts, lessons from environmental justice and climate justice communities, because we wouldn't have a climate crisis if we weren't able to offload these problems onto those communities. And that message becomes one that says, you know, basically in the same space that we've created for climate stories, we can, I think, very rapidly, because this space, like I said, has happened so rapidly, we can create that same space for the necessity to tell, the absolute necessity to tell the stories, solutions, impacts from environmental justice, climate justice communities. But I think the piece that has been missing for a long time is that fossil fuels have always been about all of these things, not just climate. They are about war, mm-hmm. peace, politics, economy, health, jobs, well-being, all of these impacts. And then folks paying attention to climate have at sometimes feel like they can just pick off this piece, right? But if you just pick off the climate piece and you don't solve all the rest of this, you actually won't solve the climate piece. Like, they have to go hand in hand. And so a lot of our fossil fuel reporting forever had been just from finance reporters, and still is to a large degree. So your financial reporter covers Exxon from its stocks and its et cetera, et cetera. And then, but you, what we need is increasingly to say that piece is really important, but it's a piece of all of these other pieces. It's about environment, it's about climate, it's about politics, it's about war, it's about peace. The whole world has just woken up to this with Ukraine in a way that they've never had before, which is really important. With the Russian war in Ukraine. But anyway, I think the more that we can say that we don't, that these fossil fuels should not be siloed into a business story, they are a part of all of these other stories, mm-hmm. is the way that I think we'll really be able to address a lot of the challenges with editors and with audience.
One of the things that I kind of changed in terms of language at CNN was, like, they always said greenhouse gas emissions in their stories, and I've since shifted that coverage to fossil fuel emissions. So I think that was really important, important change. Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Yeah.
So just, like, making that clear exactly what you said.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, when we talk about language, we also have to remember that there's what we call language justice. And our organization filed a lawsuit that materials distributed by the EPA and other federal agencies need to be translated into the prevalent language of that community. Otherwise, you know, they don't understand what's going on. But it's made a lot of progress. Translations have been made, and we hope that it continues to, you know, move on forward towards the rest of the nation for other countries that need translations in their prevalent language of their mm-hmm. community. The other issue that I think that you're dealing with is that when we talk about environmental justice, it's an issue that even EJ communities a lot of times don't know that they're an environmental justice community. And when they do find out, you know, basically the definition of what it is, they also are impacted because they don't have the resources to start addressing their concerns. And then they also realize that even if they speak out against the industry, a lot of times within the industry, of course, you also have to deal with the unions. Mm-hmm. And we have a union background, and I used to be an international union representative. So there's conflict, you know, not only with the community, but then with the labor force, who's that they all need to come together to address together, you know, the issue of environmental justice. And to have that happen, it takes a lot of time and a lot of energy, because not everybody wants to talk about EJ and the impacts it has on communities. So those are issues that a lot of times are not talked about or written about. But I think that as a journalist, you all need to see the whole gamut of the issues. And like in our case, the question would be, go to our general and go to our state representatives, our congressional folks, and tell them, you've lived there, you know the issues, why haven't you done anything about it? And when you put them on the spot, maybe they'll start taking action. But as communities putting them on the spot, they're not going to listen to communities as long as they keep getting the majority vote to get elected. They'll deal with the simple issues and not very difficult issues, but issues that take time and take energy and take a lot of, you know, organizing. They're just going to...
Hallie, you have thoughts on barriers to covering? Let's see. Let's make sure we remember the original question. Barriers to covering environmental and climate justice stories.
Juan was talking about, and actually, I don't know if anybody else was at that Indigenous and Biodiversity workshop on Wednesday, but Eileen Brown, I think was her name, from the Intercept, she was talking about using like your journalism powers, your powers as a journalist, to help the communities that you're covering, just a relationship that journalists have with the communities you're covering. And, you know, like a lot of times these kind of stories are like admired by the journalism community, and like they're award-winning, but also if they're not making change in that community, what's the point? So I think that what he's talking about are great ways to actually get communities the answers that they want and need, while also telling their story to a wider audience.
That's a great point. It actually kind of, I mean, you sort of answered my next question. No, it's fine. It's good. Sorry, that's too loud. Maybe we talked before the panel when we all talked on Zoom. We talked about things that, particularly Juan, you talked about what things that you wish journalists would do differently when reporting in frontline communities, and you said something that I think we all thought was really profound about thinking very, you know, journalists should think more thoughtfully, consider more thoughtfully how. You know, what kind of impact their journalism is having? Can you say more about that?
Yeah. Like I said, look, over the years, we've been at it for trying to help the community of Manchester for over 28 years. I made recommendations, but nobody follows up on the regular, on the recommendations, even the locally, statewide, or even at the EPA and the federal level. And as I stated earlier, we've even had three administrators already visit Manchester, and they toured the area, and they leave with, at least they leave the impression to us that we're going to do something about it. But then, in the back of our minds, we feel hopeful, and we hope that they do something about it. But then, in the back of our minds, they'll commit themselves to us, and they're going to realize that, look, the industry is huge. We are the biggest port in the nation. The busiest port. And so when you deal with that infrastructure and you think you're going to regulate it almost immediately overnight, it ain't going to happen. You know, there's power in what they do, and they also have a lot of money and resources. So it's like battling a giant that you want to beat them up and you just wish you would go away. Go back home the other time because you have a lot of army or support that says, we're going to help you. And then they go back home and say, you know, deal with Santa. It's too huge for us. So realizing, instead of, you know, dealing with the environmental concerns, then they have to see us on. A lot of our communities, those that are familiar with the RMPs, risk management plans, we're in that inner circle, and that inner circle of the RMPs is death, injury, or bodily harm. If anything, we're telling the EPA that, look, anybody that you already have data that lives in this inner circle of death, injury, or bodily harm, you should start negotiating. You know, they tell us, no, you know, that's like the worst case. Well, you know, address the worst case. Don't just talk about it. You're telling us we're in a death zone. If something happens here and you're just willing to let us live here and not start negotiating some kind of relocation or moving out of that area nationwide. Not just here in Houston. So anyway, those are big issues that we have to deal with.
You know, you just made me think of this, and I, you know, so I freelance. I face a different situation than both Hallie and Rachel do. It'd be interesting to hear everyone talk about this. And Madeline also freelances. But I was just thinking as we were talking that it seems even more important to the more that we can pitch series, if at all possible, you know, and that's very hard as a freelancer, but I have to think about it more because I don't do enough. So can you pitch 4 stories and 1 is the history and the 2nd one is the impact and the 3rd one is the solutions and the 4th one is the follow-up when you go back to the door of the agency or the elected official and you say, so, you know, we reported this and what's going to happen? And then you have a 5th one that's a year later. It's already built into the budget. That is, you're going to go back a year later and say, what happened? And I think the more that journalists are actually doing that, what happened, and plan it, that is some really important accountability journalism that meshes solutions and accountability journalism into one space in a way that I think is also really, again, just why shouldn't we be doing that? And why shouldn't it be the same journalist, if it can be, who also has that history and that experience? And I think it also brings up this question of to what extent is there a benefit of the partnership between a local community journalist and a journalist who's coming from outside partnering, because then you have the ongoing relationship, partnership, community experience, but you also have someone who can be somewhat insulated from global blowback, right? If you're coming from afar, I think we've all experienced that there is some sort of, there's an insulation that comes from being a distant journalist. There are many advantages and reasons why a journalist isn't necessarily better that they live there. But also making sure the national question is being asked both to the federal government, state government, local government, agencies, and that partnership would also be, you know, brilliant. And more news outlets are obviously trying to do this, partnering and supporting local outlets with national outlets. But I don't see as often this the series structure built in maintaining the relationship throughout the series as well.
That's a great idea. Yeah. Okay, one more question, then I'll open it up to everybody to ask your questions. And any of you can jump in on this one. On any of them, but how should journalists build respectful relationships with these communities when they're going in to report on them? Particularly thinking about the fact that folks in these communities, your sources, are maybe in positions of vulnerability. They may have had negative experiences in the past with media. They may or may not be that comfortable with outsiders walking in to ask them a lot of questions. So what's a strategy or two that the journalists have used? And Juan, what's a couple thoughts that you have about that experience of having journalists come in?
Our experience has been that, you know, we welcome journalism to come and report about the stories, especially because there's always hope in a new story coming out that, yes, maybe this will trigger some action, right? Because as we know, just reporting once on an incident, sometimes it helps immediately, and sometimes, people read about it and they say, we're sorry for those folks, right? But the continual reporting of what's going on in Manchester in our communities regarding environmental justice all along the Houston Ship Channel, it's, to me, I would tell you it's a waste of time now. And I'm not saying that all these years has not benefited any one community to date. If it had, I would say, yes, I tell journalists right now is we have to figure out how you're going to have impact. Real impact. Don't come in right, I want to write a good story about the issue, right? That brings notoriety to the writer, of course, and also exposes the issue. But does it legitimize some action actually happening to them? Our situation here in the Houston area is that there's a lot of articles that are good articles, but there's no reaction to address those in a positive manner. Mm-hmm. And we've even told the EPA administrator this, all of them that we have to deal with, that we need some action, because we hear 3 administrators that come down here, they see Manchester, they're too under a political umbrella, right? Mm-hmm. So they couldn't get anything done. So when we think about what needs to be done is that somebody needs to take, they say, the problem in hand and just say, look, enough is enough. What's happening is that it's all hope for the community, And in a lot of cases, you know, we talked earlier about what does the community think. The community, in a lot of cases, doesn't even want to talk to journalism folks anymore because they tell us it's a waste of time. Why? Yeah. What have they done? And then they pat us. But we appreciate you know, your continued support and your determination, and we love you to death. But that's not enough. You know, I thank them for that, and my wife and I thank them for that. But that's not what we're looking for. You know, what we're looking for is for that community to get help. And when is help going to turn around? So we need to, some of the articles, like I said, you need to focus on the political folks representing that area and question them. There's all the studies this year. They're in your community. Why haven't you stood up for the plate and done something about it? And then maybe we'll start getting some reactions to that because they'll be put on the history, their sad stories, all the deaths that occurred, all the incidents that they have to deal with. It's good in a sense, and we still appreciate that. I would say that. But tie it in with our elected officials. Put them on notice that, look, we're tired of going to Nasser. That would benefit that community.
Yeah. All right. I want to make sure that folks who are here have time to ask their questions. So is there any?
It's a hard pill to swallow. And really important for us all to hear. I guess the thing I was going to say is all of this is just getting, all of these pieces are getting so much worse, right? The inundation, the expansion of the build out of the plastics, LNG, petrochemical production. I mean, we're in the midst of a Biden moment where, you know, in one hand we're talking about the transition, in the other hand we're talking about how much more production we're gonna have. And there are, of course, communities on the front lines of all of those pieces that are being added right now. And how do we, you know, provide that relationship where you asked the first question, which is what I was going to say is this is our conundrum. It's the more time that you spend in a community, which is also what, you know, and Hallie said in the beginning, is the way that you're better able to tell the story of these things. I know this history. I've spent time learning it, and now I'm here to learn more. But that time is also time taken away. It's time given to you. It's time taken. And communities have less and less and less and less patience, ability to withstand providing that time. And it's a really difficult conundrum to be in, and I posed it before. I think the only thing I just wanted to add at that place is that we as journalists have to be aware how much worse things are getting for the same communities. The infrastructure is being built in the same communities, and to hear one solution, which is one, communities just want to be, many just want to be relocated, right? Mm-hmm. Like that fight to stay is over in a lot of spaces. And then you really have to think hard and have long conversations, I think, primarily about what is the conversation that needs to happen, about a respectful conversation about how much time you can give me and what your expectations can be of me as a journalist.
Can I just add one
really quick?
The same could be said with coming at this from the Pacific Island perspective, where a lot of people probably don't know that rampant militarization is going on, ongoing. A new Navy base is being built on Guam. They made those U.S. territories, and though it has a lot of climate and environmental impacts, and as you know, if the DOD was its own country, it would probably be one of the biggest polluters on Earth. And so just, I guess, getting to know the communities that are impacted in there, and I think a lot of them, it's a lot of historical legacies of injustice, right, that reporters need to consider in terms of colonization, imperialism, and just, you know, the history of those islands and their culture, and how the people in those islands are also, like, indigenous to their islands, and so just also being aware of their history and culture to what Antonia said, just doing that history, solutions and follow-up stories is really important. But most of the time when a disaster happens, say, a lot of journalists just go report on the disaster and then they leave, when in reality the story is pill to swallow again, and it's a tough line to walk. But yeah, absolutely.
Thanks for that. Okay, so I'm going to open it up to questions from everybody here. And just as a reminder, we give priority to folks who are SEJ members.
And please identify yourself when you stand up, and please make sure that you're asking a question and not just telling us something that might be. So, second row, yeah, you're right there, yeah.
Just you touched on this, Joan Upton, Climate Central. We collaborate with local outlets on coverage, and we bring data and science reporting and the local party does the local everything. There's a huge disconnect between the desire by local news outlets to cover environmental justice stories. They always want to do environmental justice stories. We'll point to a community in Madeline around the diversity issue. But what structurally does journalism and local news outlets and J schools, what are some of the solutions to this complete disconnect between some of the most heavily impacted frontline communities in America and the local newsrooms that don't really know that they exist?
Oh, I do have to repeat the question. So, do you about the disconnect in which there are a lot of frontline communities that really have urgent issues that need to be reported on, but local newsrooms maybe don't really even know that those communities are there and aren't really even familiar with what's happening there?
Do you want to add to it?
Do you mind if I enter on
Introduce yourself.
My name is Nayeli, and speaking on behalf of Tejas and from the experience of the work, I would say a lot of the people, even within the local newsrooms, don't even live within the community. Mm-hmm. So look at where are those people coming from? How long have you been in that position? Yes, you may be working for ABC 13 News, Fox, whatever, at the local level in Houston, Corpus Christi, or wherever, but where are they originally from? They might be from like north part of Texas or more affluent area. So although they're from their region, they might not be able to even speak networks and stories and people out in the community. I know I see like Becca, and I see Brian out back there that also do a lot of community organizing. So like someone mentioned, like making sure that you're spending time with the people and connecting with them and actually investing in them, because a lot of journalists are extractive. It's just what is the word? A stepping stone into another branch, a higher position, a higher network. And there's this one quote with XQ where they say that students, specifically youth, are able to tell right away when you're like BSing them. So as an educator, I always know like, okay, I have to be upfront and honest and transparent with the kids. If not, they're going to know if I'm faking it or not being true to them. So I always try to be genuine with the conversations that we have. So same with y'all. Like, if you know your intention, don't establish connections that are going to be extractive. Because in the long run, it's just going to cost and contribute more to the problem that is already there. Because you're building distrust and you're building a history of what a reporter is to a certain person, which is what we've seen in previous years.
Thank you.
I think that brings up one quick thought for me, which is just that the importance of not just parachuting into a place. When I was reporting in Alaska, I mean, there is a formal process. You have to go to the community and ask permission to go there. But I was told by one of the organizations that was working with them that they did have, like, a journalist just kind of pop in unannounced. And, I mean, if you don't build those relationships in advance, like, reach out to, like, agencies that are working with the community who are really familiar, who can help you kind of understand the situation before you go in, and trusted leaders in the community who, like, can, you know, can tell you what's going on so that you don't show up and do something stupid. you're not going to be able to come in and have a respectful sort of relationship with this.
Yeah,
like, you know, helpful quality story very well. So I think that's... Yeah, go ahead.
Just because, like, I think that it is really important for more journalists to come at that moment. So I know for me, I'm from Virginia, and I moved to New Orleans, and I didn't really have a background in covering this little historic black community called Ironton. Mm-hmm. And so when I first started wanting to, like, get to know that area and, like, what they were going through better, I just had coffee with one of their community leaders who, like, used to be a parish councilwoman. And that wasn't for a story. We just sat down for 2 hours and just chatted about what was going on. So I think that that kind of time is important. And of course, like, we're all talking about, you don't want to take up too much time because you guys have important work to do, but like just have being able to have that kind of like casual conversation and relationship is really important, and I think newsrooms should be willing to do that when you guys are pursuing stories like that.
Yeah, I think to get to this question though, there's no one to partner with. You want to partner with communities and you don't have an outlet. You want to partner with local outlets and you don't have outlets to partner with and they don't have the expertise. It just speaks to a much broader problem that we, you know, do need to name, which is the death of local journalism and how that spreads into journalism schools that don't have enough resources to provide the necessary representation from local communities that are getting the training and then have a job to go to and work within their own community to report from their community and to be there to partner. And I think, you know, it's just the importance of the more that we can be talking about the necessity that there needs to be a greater presence for environmental justice and climate justice in journalism schools, in high schools, and trying to bring that awareness earlier, that experience of climate justice stories, in the same way that we've got climate money going to climate, if there was money going to environmental and people to then report those stories. So it's not something that answers your question. Allocate some of this money then that is there right now for climate reporting, because there is so much of it, which is so wonderful. But we also know it's likely to be a fad, right? It's happened right now. Up nationally and specifically addressing environmental justice and climate justice stories. And I would be remiss if I didn't mention that I sit on the board of a grant called the Kuzik Environmental Justice Reporting Grant from the National Press Club, and we grant journalists to do environmental justice.
Pay you to like really get to know community members, and I do agree what my panelists have said, fellow panelists have said about, you know, partnering with grassroots, partnering with researchers, and getting to know the community. And I think from my personal experience, like, I think I was very ambitious coming into CNN and telling all these stories, and despite all the breaking news last year with the extreme weather events, I would take time during the evening and go out to, when after Ida happened, visit families in Queens, you know, the families that got flooded in basements, and a lot of them are still displaced right now. They're at the Radisson Hotel in near JFK Airport and in Brooklyn, and you know, I took time to report on just visiting them at the hotel, just chatting with them, and so I took that on my own time outside of, you know, my quote-unquote CNN hours, but there's no, like, reporters are never really off, but I, and my editors didn't know that before I pitched the story that, hey, I've been spending basements and are staying at this hotel, and then it came about a story on last December and how they're spending Christmas kind of displaced, not in their homes, and so I think just, I don't know, I think it was more me being ambitious, but I really invested the time in telling these stories, and I just was aware of CNN's outreach, and I knew that given CNN's outreach, they really had to tell those stories and not appear as if they went in, reported on those basement floodings, reported on Louisiana and just all the impacts of Hurricane Ida, and not check up on those communities after. So I think that's what I kind of really wanted to emphasize, and it's definitely kind of a structural systemic change within newsrooms, but yeah, partnerships and unfortunately investing time is, I think, important.
Although we only have 7 minutes, so I want to make sure we get in one more question.
Just real quick for editors to know about journalists as well, is that we're also increasingly experiencing the harms of the climate crises and the fossil fuel industries that we are reporting on as well. And so I think, you know, Hallie and I both live in New Orleans. We've been through, you know, fossil fuel pollution that we're dealing with. We all lost power through Ida, and then there were the spills as a result of Ida. But we're also, as journalists, going through that. And I think the more that editors also understand that we're also living a lot of these impacts that we're reporting on, and that's hard on us emotionally, it's hard on us financially, it's hard on us to...
Thanks. Right here, you have a question.
I'm a freelance journalist, mostly writing for Inside Climate News. A couple of points. One, of course, is that I feel that as a minority person myself, we have a little bit more immediacy to the impacted communities precisely because some of us are also coming from Colorado, people that we're trying to. So this bracket of just a very generalized bracket doesn't really apply. It's a little bit more nuanced. Secondly, I feel that the COVID or these pandemics are like bringing a completely new dynamic to the kind of relationships that we have, but can we have?
Yeah.
Is entirely different question. We can't just set aside what has happened in the last 2 years.
Yeah.
It's part of who we are now. And if you're trying to frame new questions within the same political, economic system which got us into the mess that we are, that how do you feel we're going to get new answers by framing the questions in the same bracket? And does that, and what does that really mean for our profession and for ourselves as humans?
If we're framing our questions within the sort of maybe the same language, the same conceptual frameworks that have basically created the problems that we have, which I think goes back to some of the points we were talking about language. But if we keep framing the questions in the same way, how are we really going to get to the answers that really change things or really deal with the problems effectively? Anyone want to take that on?
The thing that comes to my head is, what can I pitch? You know, it's also part of like, what can you pitch that an editor will take? And I'm going to say how much? Yeah, it's basically I'm going to say like, how much can I challenge in the framework? And that's really what you're challenging us to challenge, which is really important. Like, how challenging can we be? Is the challenge, and I'm probably blushing a lot, but it's really hard. It's very hard to do. It's very hard to do. So I'm just going to say that.
I mean, my go-to question, I don't know. It's, you know, we have our go-to kind of list of questions that's relevant to our story angle. And at the end, you know, we say, do you have anything else that you'd like to add? But I also add, like, is there a question that I didn't ask but should have that needs to be emphasized? And so I think that is, like, the best question where the person you're interviewing has probably been holding back and has been, he or she or they might have a thought that's been, like, lingering behind their head, like, the whole time as you're asking questions. But I don't know if that even answers your question, but it might be relevant to the, you know, that framework.
Thanks. Okay, we have like 3 minutes. So does somebody have a really brief question?
Most of us were raised to think about how much our circulation, how many people read our stuff. That's not the key question. The key question is how many people remember what they read. And the answer to that is, put one sentence in there, it's behind that, your retention of your audience will double.
You mentioned solutions in your story because that will help people kind of retain it, ground it in their reality, think about it more. And there's, hi.
Hi, my name is Allison Cagle. I'm a writer at all the workshops that I've been to so far, so thank you for your and the fatigue that you're talking about is actually exactly why I stopped working at traditional newspapers and went to an advocacy organization. I have an option to report on the victories, and I will say, in a similar question, as a journalist of color, I told my editors I don't want to only write about subjects who are defined by their oppression only, and it's very hard for me to think of other angles that are more empowering or focus more on their passion or the thing that they love about their community, why they're fighting about their community, that isn't just the same story of, look at this person of color, let's only photograph them as in a situation in distress. Like, can you do something that changes the narrative of these are only lines of victimization? I wonder if you have any, just any thoughts on different angles to bring, different era. Is there a less victimizing angle to tell the story of, unfortunately, environmental racism? It's a hard question.
So I think we can do like lightning answers. And I actually do have one that pops straight into mind, which really is the one that you guys have already said, but I think when you emphasize and ask about solutions that are coming out of the community and what they're trying to grow, then you can tell a much more hopeful story about your sources as subjects who are, you know, have agency over things that are happening and kind of elevate those solutions.
What else?
Yeah, okay. Agency solutions as well. I covered when I was writing a story about this woman in Guam who's a member of the Micronesia Climate Justice Alliance. She talked about how some of the solutions, because Pacific Islanders have been on the front lines of climate crisis for as long as we can remember. They're literally connected by ocean, the ocean. And so she talked about some of the innovative but also traditional indigenous solutions that kind of, I guess an example is using coconut oil to power like their boats. Those are some of the solutions that she talked about when you're going on an inter-island cruise or using just Western science and combining it with ancestral wisdom is what she would emphasize. But there's a lot more examples out there if you really talk to the community members, and I'm speaking again from a Pacific Islander's point of view.
Thank you so much for that. And for me, I think it's doing as much as we can to honor both pieces or all of those pieces of the person, because people, in my experience, want you to understand the difficulty. They want you to understand their position that they are living in and the difficulties that have been placed upon them. And then as much space, more space to all of the agency advocacy work that they are doing. And they don't have to be an activist to have agency, right? They you know, to really give the space and the respect and the time to all of the ways that agency is being implemented, and to let your and to make your editors let you do that. I have so many editors that want to edit just to the problem and all of the ways that you can define this person as a disadvantaged person. Much more representation on agency advocacy where it's there.
We're already, just so you know, we're already 2 minutes over, so really quick, quick thoughts.
It's important.
A quick comment that generally when conferences like this take place with other industries, other than in journalists, elected officials come and welcome you, right? But when it's about environmental issues, people away from you know? So think about that, because they're absent, you know? They don't want to talk to you about the issues.
Yeah, and I just, I don't know if this response is really helpful for you because you seem like more on a national level of their oppression, but also like when I was covering coastal tribes in Houma, I would also cover their culture camp. And so I think that it's important to cover those types of things as well, not just the struggles that they have.
Mm-hmm. And people as a part of, people not just as individuals, but a part of communities and a part of communal organizing. As a part of organizing structures or community structures, it also then gets you away from the isolating the individual as the source of either the problem or the exclusive solution.
All right. Thanks to our wonderful panelists. And feel free to come up and chat with us now. And there's a coffee break.
Yeah.
So go have coffee.